Eric Von Crumley.
And I'm Romy Reyes.
Have you ever wondered how a book becomes a movie?
Or how a movie becomes a musical?
Or how anything is adapted at all?
Join us as we talk about your favorite stories and all the changes that were made along the way.
But more importantly, why? This is Willing to Adapt.
Hi, welcome back to Willing to Adapt. I am Eric Von Crumley.
And I'm Romy Reyes.
How's it going?
I'm doing good.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Today we are talking about Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson.
Yes.
We are also going to be talking a little bit about the Disney live action adaptation.
It's not live action.
We're going to talk a little bit about the 1950 movie.
Oh, yes. Sorry. I forgot about that one.
But then our main focus is going to be on Treasure Planet.
Correct.
Which is definitely the more interesting one to talk about. I like both of them, but I grew up with both, but yeah. Did you have any comments before we talk about Robert Louis Stevenson?
Nope.
All right. Do you want to talk about him or shall I? Do you have a little biography in that little book there?
Let me see.
Romy has a really cool copy of Treasure Island where it looks like a tattoo on the front.
It's the Puffin Classics version. Apparently, it's part of their children's lit books. So here, yes, I have a little things on Robert Louis Stevenson. He was born in November 13th, 1850, which is not far from the day we're recording, month-wise, not year-wise, in Edinburgh, Scotland. He died in 1894. He's Scottish, if you haven't guessed already. He lived all over the world, but mostly in Scotland, France, Switzerland, USA for a little while, Australia, and the South Pacific. He was married to an American named Fanny Osborne, and he had two stepchildren, Lloyd and Belle. He was an adventurous soul trapped in a weak body. He suffered from tuberculosis, and at the time it was incurable, and often most people would eventually die from it, and he did at the age of 44. But in those 44 years, he was able to live and experience more things than I think most people would have, you know, do if they lived to 80. He grew up in Edinburgh, Scotland. He suffered from tuberculosis from an early age. He often spent long months indoors, mostly in bed. And during this time is when he started making up stories to entertain himself. And back at this time, there was no airplanes, no travel. And any travel was uncomfortable and dangerous, but he eventually aspired to travel around the world, which he did. One interesting thing I remember it says right here is that he was suspected of being a spy by the French. Police. And another thing was I don't know if this was a good thing or not, but he fell in love with his wife, but she was married at the time. And he ended up convincing her to divorce her husband to marry him. And then eventually when he moved to the South Pacific, he became deeply involved in the native culture. And this was a time when most Europeans and Americans automatically looked at savages as, you know, cannibals and uncivilized, and he talks about it. But honestly, even in the book, it comes across that way when Jim says something. Maybe I'm thinking.
I mean, the book's very pro-English.
Yeah.
But I remember, I think you're probably going to talk about it, Stevenson was very pro-Samoan, like, independence.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, it didn't really go that much in that. I read that on Wikipedia. So his books, he was a bestseller during his time. He wrote books for children, was Treasure Island, it was written for children. Yes.
Yes.
But his other
specifically
books.
Written for young boys.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that's right. Because
he wanted to write like the best buccaneer story that every young boy would like.
Mm-hmm. And I did read that it was inspired by his stepson, that apparently they created a treasure map.
And yeah, I think when he would play with his son, he would play as pirates, and a lot of the original fun came from that, and he just kind of expanded on it and tried to make really detailed version of it, I guess.
Yeah.
But he pulled from a lot of real pirates and folklore and things like that.
That's what I read. I read the only thing that he kind of added that is not fully true about pirates is the whole walking the plank thing. Not that it happens in the book, but it's mentioned once. I think Jim mentions it in passing at one point. But other than that, everything else, I think that was like one of the few things that was even a misconception at that time.
I don't know. I think it's one of those things where, you know, pirates kind of become larger than life.
Yeah.
And so there's certain things that, I mean, pirates did a lot of really bad things.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
So I think it's just one of those things that maybe someone did it once, or it just took on a life larger than it was. And
yeah, it's not that they didn't do it, but it was, it's not common like we, when we think of it right. as.
Well, it's funny because nowadays when we think of pirates, we're actually heavily we pull a lot of what we think of as pirates from this book.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, I noticed that when I was reading. Yeah. And in fact,
because there are different forms of pirates. The pirates, basically, it's just thieves and murderers and looters and
yeah. So. Well, I mean, maybe I'll talk about this later. But even how the people tied to making the Disney version of this of Treasure Planet were later on tied to the Pirates movies, you know, and I don't know where they got their ideas from. Of course, from other stuff beyond Treasure Island, but it. In one of the videos I watched, to talk about how Treasure Island was a inspiration for them from when they were kids, basically. So, yeah, it talks about how Treasure Island was very popular when it first came out. It's even rumored that the British Prime Minister of the time stayed up all night to read it because he was trying to figure out what happened.
Well, it was even popular in America, too.
Was it?
Yeah, I think they were talking about how they were, I think even the president read it or something.
Oh, wow. Okay. He did write some other books. I think the only one that most people would be familiar with is The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, which I think I've read, but I can't remember. He wrote another one called The Child's Garden of Verses and then Kidnapped, which I've heard of.
I've read that one.
Did you read? Have you read it?
Yeah, that one's very pro-Scotland.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, okay. It's set during the Jacobite Rebellion.
Oh, okay. I think I wanted to read it back in the day, but I never did.
It's definitely one of those books that if you like history, it's really good. Mm-hmm. And I think in adaptation, it can be really good adaptation. But it's one of those books that relies a lot on historical narrative.
Oh, okay.
And so as a story, it is interesting, but it kind of pulls away from the story a lot to talk about the historical aspects.
Hmm. All right. And that's pretty much all I have about him.
Great. Well, real quick, Treasure Island, it originally was entitled The Sea Cook, A Story for Boys. It's an adventure and historical novel. It was published in 1883, and it tells the story of buccaneers and buried gold. It's set in the 1700s, and it's considered a coming-of-age story, and it's noted for its atmosphere, characters, and action. And I will say that's true, because when I read it this time, it really kind of came alive in my head.
Interesting. Okay.
What about you?
So it's the first time I read it, of course.
That answers my next question.
Yes. And so I had a chance to read it when I was a kid. My mom bought it for me, but I ended up reading other books instead. I never got around to it.
You said, oh, gosh, give me a book on calculus or something.
Funny enough, that was about the time I was reading.
Let me read the dictionary.
I did actually read the dictionary. I was into encyclopedias, dictionaries, things like that.
Yes, I remember this from the Secret of Nim episode.
Mm-hmm. And so I regretted not reading it, and so I was glad we decided to do this. And I will say in the beginning I was a little, I think up until the sea voyage started, I was a little bored at first. But the chapters that really captured my imagination, which I don't know why, but I would gladly reread them again, because I ended up reading them out loud, is the Carbuncle.
Why?
The way he writes about what happens when he's in the Carbuncle or when he's getting on board the ships. Let me explain what the carbuncle is. A carbuncle. I can't remember. He explains it in the book, but it's basically an early.
It's funny because I think mine called it something else.
Maybe I'm saying it wrong.
I think you are.
Okay. Let me look up the chapter. Thankfully, the...
A carbuncle is not a good thing.
What?
A carbuncle is like similar to like a boil or something.
Yeah, I thought so. Okay, so the ebb and tide... Oh, sorry. Yeah, I'm using the wrong word. The coracle. So the cruise of the coracle. Wrong word.
I was so confused. I'm like, where was this in the book?
not the boil. The coracle. So the Jeez. Chapter from the ebb tide runs probably to the cruise of the coracle, the writing of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a part of it was because there was very little talking in those two chapters. It was all.
There's a big time jump in the book when the voyage basically just gets passed over.
Yeah. And so this is when they're on the island. Yeah. He meets a castaway or a guy who's left there. And the guy who was there created a little boat called a coracle. And I guess it's the term they use for...
I'll give a quick synopsis after you're done.
Okay. An so early,
people know what we're talking about.
Yeah, an early type of primitive boat. And so when he uses the primitive boat to get to the main boat, he spends a whole chapter, the author spends a whole chapter telling about him getting there.
Yeah, you really liked that, didn't you?
I really did, because it was...
You know what's funny is I hated that.
I kind of wondered if you would. I liked the prose, the way he wrote it, just, I could see it all
like,
in my
it was
head.
Interesting, like, I enjoyed it enough, but it dragged on. I was like, just get funny to the enough, ship already.
I felt the other parts, different parts, dragged on, but that one I really liked.
And then, I'm always reminded the more that we do this, how analytical you and like and detail oriented you are. Mm-hmm. You're like, I want to know about every minute detail about how this was accomplished, and I'm like, I want to understand the emotional effect that was going on here.
Yeah, I can emotions.
Give me
fine.
The adventure and the emotion, and you're like. Give me
funny
give
enough.
Me, what was the boat made of? Was it made of goat skin? How long was it took to make?
I'll actually address that.
People like you are why we have Wikipedia entries. I'm just going to say that.
Pretty much. Actually, that's another thing I used to do in my spare time was read Wikipedia.
I thought you were going to say we just go on and correct people.
I would, but yeah, it's another story. I think I'm banned from Wikipedia. Anyway,
so did you have more to that? Or
so no, I was going to say that it's that what you just said will tie into my critique of Treasure Planet.
Great. I know you probably hate it. Anyway,
we'll get to that.
We'll get to that. So that answers my question. You have not read it until now for this podcast.
Correct. Yes.
We're not breaking precedents.
No.
I read it as a kid. Mm-hmm. I think it was one of those books that I had that someone gave to me, because it's just like the stereotypical all boys should read this book kind of thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which I kind of agree. I think it's a great book for boys. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a call to adventure, a kind of coming of age, kind of like get out of your comfort zone and experience life and challenge yourself and all that. I mean, it's just fun. And I think a lot of boys just like pirates, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It's just kind of fun. The freedom and the danger and so on. But as a kid, I didn't really like it. I think I got halfway through the book.
Okay.
And I think I gave up on it as a kid. I don't remember how old I was. I think I was ill-prepared for the format of the book. I was very used to more modern literature.
When you say modern as a kid, what are you referencing?
I just mean more like I wasn't used to
like the Cat in the
authors.
Hat or...
No, okay. I wasn't used to authors going that in depth on information.
Yeah, he is like a kid's version of who wrote what's his name, Victor Hugo.
Sure. Yeah. Well, because Robert Louis Stevenson wrote to boys.
Yeah.
And to be fair, I think boys were more educated back then, especially his audience, but. I think a lot of the literature that a lot of boys or people will read today is not as analytical. Like, it's more of just very action-based, very let's move on to the next thing and not talk about how things are done and stuff. Whereas Robert Louis Stevenson, I should just say Stevenson because it's going to get along.
Yeah.
Stevenson will explain, this was made from this and I had to do this to get across this, and which he doesn't. To be fair, he doesn't do as in depth as some other people. But
yeah.
But you know, when you're like 10 or 12,
yeah,
and you're just kind of wanting to read for the fun of it, you don't want to sit there and feel like you're in school, you know.
Yeah, but he did write also for the what is it, 1850s when he wrote the book.
He wrote it in 1880s.
I'm really off. It doesn't matter. Yeah, but I mean, it was a different era, and I think back then, too, children were already learning Latin at, what, 5, 6?
Well, the educated children were.
Yeah.
It was published in 1883. Yeah. But, anyway, so I read it as a kid, and it was one of those books I really wanted to be into, but I had a hard time with. But I also, as a kid, grew up with a lot of old school Disney. And so I grew up with the first Disney adaptation from 1950.
Okay.
The live action one. And the live action one from 1950 is actually really good.
Yeah.
And I would say, we'll talk about it more later, but it's very faithful for the most part with some small changes.
Yeah.
It's very faithful to the book, but it picks up the pace a lot, and not because it's a film, it doesn't go as in detail.
Mm.
So then coming from that, I go to read the book, and then it's like, it just drags on as a kid, you know?
And I kind of wonder, though, if they added a lot more detail because there was no television and other things.
No, yeah, for sure.
You know, and so their imaginations were all, like, they had to, he had to map everything out. That's probably why I liked the Carbuncle chapter.
I like why he did it.
Yeah.
And it was good for then. But some of the things that I did not enjoy even now were when he would talk about all the different types of plants that were on the island. Which I like from the point of view of, like, I want to visualize it. But it was also like, I don't care. I was like, move on. What is Jim doing now, you know?
Yeah.
So I think this is the first time I actually finished the book.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And you actually read it or did you listen to it?
No, I read it.
Okay.
I listened to part of it.
Okay.
Yeah. When I'd be busy doing things like setting up at church for things or whatever, I would listen to an audio version of it. But
yeah.
Most of it I read.
Okay.
But I liked reading it because the book I have, I think maybe the Barnes & Noble classic.
Mm-hmm.
And so it has the footnotes and the endnotes. And so it explains some things.
Oh, okay. Yeah, mine didn't have any of that.
So it explains some of like the sailor talk and.
Oh, I did like have a glossary.
Yeah.
So I did learn some. I did learn some pirate speak.
Yeah, but I enjoyed it. I'm glad I gave it another chance, if only for this podcast, because I actually really enjoyed it this time.
Good. Yeah. No, I enjoyed it as well. You probably guessed.
All right. Do you want me to give a synopsis for the book?
Go ahead.
All right. So Jim Hawkins is a young boy who lives at his parents' inn, the Admiral Benbow, near Bristol, England. It's in the 18th century, and an old sea captain named Billy Bones dies at the inn after being presented with a black spot, which is the official pirate verdict of guilt or judgment. Jim is stirred to action by the spot and its mysterious, accurate portent of Billy's death. I'm reading this from SparkNotes. Hastily, Jim and his mother unlock Billy's sea chest, finding a logbook and map inside. They run away just in time for the pirates to show up and basically ransack the inn. After meeting with Dr. Livesey and Squire Trelawney, they learned that he has uncovered a treasure map from the infamous Captain Flint. And it leads to the secret treasure that he has compiled over the years. And so quickly, Dr. Livesey and Squire Trelawney team up to start a sea voyage and get a crew and the ship, which ends up being the Hispaniola. And in the book, Squire Trelawney fixes up the inn for Jim and his mother. And what you find out very quickly that when they go to get onto the ship, that Squire Trelawney has essentially hired a bunch of the crew through a cook named Long John Silver. While they're on the ship, the captain and his first mate talk to them, and they basically say they do not trust most of the crew and they do not like them. While they are on the voyage, the first mate falls overboard after behaving horribly drunk for most of it, and you find out later on that he was actually being, like, given the alcohol by Long John Silver on the voyage.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And Jim overhears, while in an apple barrel, he overhears Long John Silver and a bunch of the other crew members plotting to have a mutiny. And they're recruiting other members of the crew. And so Jim tells the doctor and the squire and the captain, and they prepare to abandon most of the crew on the island. But then the crew essentially take over once they get the ship to the island. Long story short, Jim ends up on the island with the pirates, and he runs into a man who was marooned on the island named Ben Gunn. He's been on the island for 3 years. And essentially has gone a little crazy because of it. And Ben Gunn tells Jim of a little boat he's put together that you talked about. What's it called again?
The Carbuncle. The Coracle.
Jeez. The Coracle.
Coracle, yes.
When the doctor and the rest of the crew that make it get to shore. They stop and hold base at a stockade, and Jim goes to them, and they fight off the pirates. They have a truce with Long John for a short bit, and then Jim takes off, and he ends up getting it in his head that he's gonna go and essentially beach the ship. It's a long about thing. Like he takes off the anchor, but then he ends up going on the ship eventually, and he has an encounter with one of the pirates that he ends up having to shoot so he can protect himself.
Mm-hmm.
He beaches the ship somewhere and he hides it from the pirates. And when he gets back after being hurt, he finds that the doctor, Dr. Livesey, the squire, and the captain, and whoever was left have abandoned the stockade and have essentially given it to the pirates on Long John Silver. And you find out later that they had been working with Ben Gunn, and they got to the treasure first because Ben Gunn had taken it from its hiding spot. So when Jim is stuck with the pirates, Long John kind of turns against the pirates to protect Jim and try to save his own butt, essentially.
Yep.
And long story short, you know, the good people get the treasure, and Long John ends up getting away because on the voyage home, they stop off in, was it Spanish America, it said?
It was, yeah.
Yeah.
Spanish America.
And he ends up stealing away on a boat. And there's a little afterword, which I thought was fun, where it talks about them back in England.
Yeah, it did.
And it talks about how Ben Gunn basically, like, lost all his money. And
he was a typical lotto winner.
Yes. And they say, you know, Long John's out there somewhere, and I can't help but think that hopefully he's doing okay, you know.
Funny enough, they don't say how Jim and the doctor and the squire ended up, but leave that to your imagination.
They basically kind of say that they're just fine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They just mentioned the captain.
Mm-hmm. Who retired, yeah.
Retired, and the other guy, the one sailor who survived, mm-hmm. Gray.
Basically, yeah. And I think he was one of the squire's servants, right?
Was he? I couldn't remember.
I know the squire brought two of his servants on board, so.
Okay.
The novel was originally serialized from 1881 to 1882 in the children's magazine Young Folks under the title Treasure Island or The Mutiny of the Hispaniola. It was credited to the pseudonym Captain George North, and it was first published as a book on 14th of November, 1883. It has since become one of the most often dramatized and adapted novels.
Interesting.
And this even goes on to say what we said already, that Treasure Island has significantly influenced depictions of pirates in popular culture, including elements such as deserted tropical islands, treasure maps marked with an X, and one-legged seamen with parrots perched on their shoulders and eye patches.
Pieces of eight.
Yes. In the book, Long John Silver has a parrot that he's named Captain Flint that is basically like the alarm.
Pretty much, yeah. And that's what he says. Pieces of eight. Pieces of eight.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So, did you enjoy the book?
Yes, I did. I will say it wasn't like, there were times, up in like most books, there were times when I was more into it than others.
Mm-hmm.
I did listen to part of it on audio.
Okay.
And then I went back and read it again because I realized I wasn't paying attention because I was paying more attention to the accents. He was doing a lot of piratey accents.
Sure.
It's the guy who played he was in Pirates of the Caribbean. He played the older pirate that was like the right-hand man of Jack Sparrow.
Mr. Gibbs?
Is that what he goes by?
I think that's his name in the movie.
Okay, possibly. I think
the one that he gets at Tortuga, who's sleeping with the pigs.
Yes, yes.
Yes.
That, yeah. So he did all the voices.
Okay, I can see that.
And so when I went back, I realized I was just enjoying it like I would a TV show, and so I had to go back and read it.
You weren't analyzing it.
I was not. And then reading it helped a lot, but then I found myself making pirate voices.
I like listening, but I retain more information when I read it.
So do I, yeah.
I found a version that was dramatized, mm-hmm. and I was really excited for a second because it had, I think, Catherine Tate in it.
Okay.
And I was like, ooh. And I was like, but then I was like, but there really aren't any females in this except his mother. So she was the mom.
So
she didn't last very long. But in that version, it was not a faith. It was faithful, but it was like almost like a play version. So mm-hmm. they added a bunch in and they changed some of it.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. And so it was not like a reading of the book. It was.
Okay.
So I had to stop that because it didn't help me. But
yeah, no, this was an unabridged adaptation. And in the end, I did enjoy it. I want to say for some reason in the beginning when he's in the Benbow Inn, That did not capture my attention very much. I think it was very, like, you could tell it's a kid. It's written for children. Mm-hmm. And I think, I don't know, just for some reason, the opening didn't capture. But it, like I said, once they started the voyage, and really once they got to the stockade, I think the stockade on really captured my attention. And I was really, in fact, I remember one night, I decided to go to the back of the book and read the glossary and the, like, the piratey dangerous information. And so I'm reading the back of the book and I'm falling asleep. And and I mean, yes, I was tired. It was a long day. I was exhausted, but it was putting me to sleep. And then I said, well, I want to read at least 30 more pages before I go to bed. So I switched back to the novel and I was awake for the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, that was a big sign.
The book
that
is kind of hard to put down.
It is. It is. And then I realized how much I enjoyed it.
The chapters are relatively short.
Mm-hmm. I will say, as a kid's book, I did miss the characters. I don't want to say they were flat, but they were flatter than...
A lot of older literature, especially like this mm-hmm. genre,
yeah,
is purely for the adventure
okay.
and the storytelling. And it's a lot less focused on like some of the character development that we're used to now
mm-hmm.
and like the nuances that we'll find in characterizations now.
Mm-hmm.
And so once you get around that, it's fine.
Yes.
Like when you go into it just knowing, I'm going into this for it to be fun
mm-hmm.
and I'm going into this to just go on an adventure, not to analyze characterizations and stuff.
And that makes sense because now I could see why it took me a while to get into it in the beginning. I think this is what the first time we've done. Have we done anything from this era? Not including Shakespeare's older.
I mean, we've done plays and stuff, but it's okay. different.
And so even Alice in Wonderland is very different because you can feel the emotion in it. But that's also a
later time.
And that
one's also kind of in a league of its own.
So. Yeah. And so I think it took me a while to get used to that. But once I did,
yeah.
And comparing it to the movie later on,
right.
the animated feature.
Yeah. Treasure Planet.
The Treasure Planet. Yeah. I think I was able to. So this is kind of how I did it. I read most of the book. No, I read the intro to the book, watched the live action. Like the first. I got to the point of the voyage. I know. I got up to the point of the voyage and the loss of Mr. Arrow or whatever they call him.
Yeah, Mr. Arrow.
Watched the
first mate.
The movie, came back, read it all the way up to the Coracle, watched Treasure
and
Planet.
You're like, oh, the Coracle.
And
oh.
then yes. And then went back and I finished the book. And so I was able to kind of compare them a little bit differently because of that.
Sure. One thing that is important to remember is the book is meant to be told retrospectively.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And at the very beginning of the book, Jim actually says the doctor has requested that I write this down. And so there are times in it where he purposefully omits information
mm-hmm.
because he says they have not retrieved the rest of the treasure yet.
Oh, okay.
And so I think that helps when you kind of keep that in mind,
mm-hmm.
that it's meant to be Jim looking back on it. And so it's in a way kind of just matter of fact.
Okay.
So it's like this happened and this happened. And so he has some commentary where he'll say like, I don't really know why I did this, but I did this.
Yeah. And then because I caught that when he was talking about he saw these weird creatures and now he knows they're sea lions. But
yeah,
at the time,
he
didn't know
they
were
like slugs.
They look like slugs. That's
but
what
I do like that because that's something that people don't think about. Right. A lot of people don't think about how up until like modern globalization,
mm-hmm.
people from like different cultures around the world would not be familiar with some of
yeah.
like the like agriculture and the flora and fauna mm-hmm. and customs obviously and
yeah.
even some of the clothing and stuff. And so like if you like obviously they didn't have internet like we do,
yeah,
but like they didn't have television, they didn't have movies, and so if you didn't have access to books and you were looking at like illustrations or something from another country, like you would have no idea what something would be unless you went there, you know?
That's true, yeah. Or you'd seen a picture, Audubon's Book of Birds, and I don't know what they had for animals.
Sure.
And in, even the other thing I think I found interesting, and I don't know how many people would have picked up on this, but nerdy me, was the doctor constantly, or Jim constantly referencing
the sickness of the island by them being in the bogs and the marshes and malaria and things like that.
Yeah,
and
the doctor's talking about how people were already getting sick on the ship and they're getting worse on the island.
Yeah.
I liked it because I don't know if this was the intention, but it almost seemed like there was the parallel mm-hmm. between them getting physically sick and also, you know, turning against the crew and becoming like they were always pirates, but like doing all these evil things and in search of the treasure, like it's overcoming them, like this mm-hmm. this greed and stuff. It's almost like the physical ailments were paralleled in that.
Yeah.
But I also liked that because it was kind of realistic to what a sea voyage would be. You know, like people would get sick and there would probably be diseases on an island that you've never been to.
Mm-hmm. The marshland and the swamp. It was interesting. It was interesting seeing it medical perspective from that era. What about the characterization of the different characters?
It was kind of fun. They did not feel like stock characters at all.
Mm-hmm.
They did feel a little flat, which was okay. Because like I said, once I got to the
I think Jim did the most for me.
Jim's the one that bothered me the most.
Okay,
but I think I did a lot. I think I did a lot of. I gave a lot of allowances in the book
mm-hmm.
to the characters, especially Jim. Jim Hawkins is one of my favorite characters in general, but I think because I'm more used to the adaptations, that did not help.
Mm.
I think it is meant to be kind of a coming of age story in that it's him trying to understand like what it is to become a man.
Yeah.
And being put in these circumstances. One of the things I did read somewhere when we talk about Treasure Planet for sure is in the book, Jim kind of just comes off from the get-go assured and mm-hmm. confident and just ready to get to work.
Yeah.
Which is great and fine. Like in the 1700s and even in the 1800s, you know, the idea of being a child is not what it is now.
Yeah.
Like you definitely worked as a child unless you were just wealthy. And so like the fact that he's like serving alcohol at an inn is not a weird thing back then.
Oh yeah.
But you know, there is not a lot of character growth, and I think in a modern eyes, we're used to that.
Yeah, I don't know how much of this is just because of the era, or how much of it is the author and things like that.
Yeah,
I did watch one video where they were talking about Treasure Planet mostly,
right?
But they referenced the book, and one of the things that stuck out to me, and they mentioned it, is the fact that in the book he has both his parents. He grew up with both his parents.
He did, and In the very beginning of the book, his father is sick and then dies.
Correct.
That's the one thing that bothered me. One of the things that bothered me about the book, and I'll let you finish, is they just really gloss over that.
Yeah,
like the fact that his father dies.
Yeah.
It was almost an afterthought.
And it didn't really... And honestly, I didn't mind it as much. I feel like I've read a number of books where you'll have a main parent who just is dead. And they just die in the beginning of the first few chapters, and then that's it. And I think we're so used to parent issues that
we're so used to parent issues.
Well, no, today's generation, I think today's culture, sorry, not generation, today's culture is so used to, I mean, we've been inundated with the therapeutic, you know. In many ways, it's the triumph of the therapeutic. Shout out to Philip Reeve. Anyway, and that's the name of a book. And so because of that, we automatically therapize. we put into therapeutic perspective almost everything. We talked about mm-hmm. this loosely with the fables, with Sleeping Beauty, about how many scholars read too much into it.
Right.
And so I think in this case, while the death of the father did not stick out to me, what did stick out to me, and I actually kind of appreciated seeing this, was the fact that there's a line where Jim says, "I know I should have told my mother," when they were chasing after there were, or something like that, when he was right at the beginning, when the whole hullabaloo was going on regarding the captain, what is his name? Bones? Captain Bones.
And Billy Bones.
Billy Bones, yeah. And when Pew comes looking for them. And I remember there was one point where he says, I should have told my mom. And it stuck out to me because so much of today's children's literature is the parent is not there, or there's no adult figures that are influential, or they're kind of loosely there, or they don't understand. They don't get it. I'm on my own. And I thought that it was just one.
Or you get like the really overbearing one.
Yeah, or that. And I think it was really interesting to see the connection between him and his mother. And it was nothing major, you know, but it was just that line really threw it out. And then kind of the way where they run away together and the way he's thinking of her and stuff like that.
Yeah, I think one of the differences also between some of the literature from around the time this was written and more mm-hmm. modern literature
yeah.
is when you're reading books from this time period, especially, it is expected that you are going to do a little bit of casual critical thinking
mm-hmm.
and that you are going to be doing some of the work on your own by mm-hmm. piecing things together.
Yeah.
Whereas a lot of modern literature would actually spell it out a lot more for you.
Okay.
So in what I kind of pieced together from reading this time around, at the very beginning, it doesn't say it to you. And yeah. like, you know, this could be me just pulling it from my own head.
Mm-hmm.
But when you read at the very beginning, Jim saying, my father was ill
mm-hmm.
and things were difficult and I was working. I read that as I am learning to figure out what it means to be independent and be the man of the house and to take responsibility and to step up.
Mm.
Like, it doesn't spell it out,
yeah.
but it's kind of written in between the lines a bit.
Yeah, I don't think I thought of it quite. I didn't put it into words in my head.
But it also kind of prepares you for him going on the journey eventually.
No, I agree. I agree. Yeah. Yeah, I just hadn't thought of it that way. But yeah, I agree with you on that.
Whereas nowadays, everything I said to you would probably be in the book.
Yeah.
Like, Jim would actually say that.
Yeah.
I sat there at the counter and I thought of my father sick upstairs and I was nervous. I didn't know what to do when the next man would come in asking for rum.
And and it's funny because my wife and I, she watched, of course, all this, and I read some of the book to her as she was falling asleep. And one of the things, I watched a video by a therapist, and I came across a therapist who watched the movie, and they had read the book.
Which movie?
Treasure Planet. And it was him, I guess he does this podcast, not podcast, sorry, it's a YouTube channel, and he does a YouTube channel with some other guy who's in the film industry.
There's so many, like, therapists and people who do, yeah. psychiatrists who will, like, do the therapist watches this movie?
Yeah. And
I don't watch those videos.
I normally don't either, but I was curious, being that I come out of that field, I was curious as to how they handled it. And it kind of
feeds. Don't lie. You wanted to be ready to argue with them, right?
Pretty much. I do have some arguments with them, actually. And this is what I was discussing with my wife about, was that I noticed that.
And let's not get too much into Treasure Planet yet.
No. But what I noticed from them was that they were getting into the story from a personal perspective. Just like you were saying right now about the way they would write for children today, or for young people, young adults especially. It's all about the I, me, what's going on inside. And that's what they were pulling from, was what does it pull out of you? And one of the things I think my wife and I both agreed on was that, both of us having studied psychology and coming out of that field, we both immediately were thinking about a more systemic level, you know, like about, not about how I felt. Because some people are like, oh, well, Jim doesn't have a father in any of the versions. I mean, in the book, he's there for a little while. But in general, and so they start discussing about how that made them feel. Whereas her and I were immediately thinking about the more higher level of what it's, you know, about the importance of fathers and how that played out in the different stories.
Well, it's fun because in the book and in the live action adaptation, I always kind of felt in a way that Dr. Livesey was like a proxy father.
Yes, I agree.
And one of the things I really like about the book is it kind of talks in a way that's less about the individual, more about like the community.
Yes.
And about more of like shipmates and like we're in this together
mm-hmm.
and we have to work together. And like, it is Jim's story. He's the one telling it. He's the protagonist. And it is technically his journey. But you really get the sense that this is our journey.
And it's not a child against the adults.
Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. Like, it, in a way, it really felt like Jim was treated like an adult by the characters.
No, I agree.
And even the captain at the very beginning hints this and then says it flat out at the end that Jim is his favorite.
Yeah. No,
and he says early on, I refuse to have favorites on ships, so you basically need to stay away from me.
Yeah.
And the other thing I like about it, obviously, is it's very accurate to the perceptions of the time period in that it's not afraid to talk about God. It's not afraid to talk about... Yeah. You know, different aspects that would be like the patriotism of the English and things like that.
Oh, yeah, for King George or the, I think the funny one. It even adds to the
part
story.
About like, I need to make sure I raise the Union Jack.
The Union Jack, yeah. And then the, I can't remember his name, but he's the one that he pulls the page out of the Bible to do the black dot.
Is it George Mary or?
I can't remember.
It's one of them.
Yeah. And in the end, it talks about the superstition and how, you know, he could be punished. You know, maybe God's punishing him because he tore a piece of the Bible out, you know.
Yeah. I mean, it's bad theology, but it's
it is bad theology, but still, it's true.
Well, it's fun
though,
because you know,
think.
Like you know that Long John Silver is just totally using that to manipulate him.
Oh yeah. So, should we talk about him in the book?
You want to talk about Long John Silver?
I do. I actually do, because that was one character
I wanted to ask you a question about him, but say your thing.
Is that also coming from a psychological perspective? He struck me as very psychopathic in the book. In the book,
explain.
So, in the book. Not that he doesn't have redeeming qualities, because granted, just because you have psychopathic tendencies does not mean you're doomed to murder or steal or rob or whatever, because you have CEOs, family men, people who have those tendencies that do well. So in what for me was the fact that, as we'll explore in the other two versions, how his relationship with Jim, in here... His relationship with Jim, that, and I think this is why you said, and I feel the same way, that Dr. Livesey was more of a father figure in the book, because Jim's relationship with Long John is very transactional for him, for Long John. And it's like that for everyone. And I think for me, the best example of that is he begins just like a normal psychopath would, making friends with everyone, only to shoot someone right in the middle, you know, when they first get to the island. He has no qualms about pulling his gun out and shooting someone. Mm-hmm. You do see a little humanity as with things, but you don't know how much of it is tied to his survival.
Yeah, because he's not a black and white villain. You know?
No,
like,
he's not.
I think he's fun because he's very readable as human.
Yeah.
Whereas it's very easy in like an adventure story for something to be just a very flat villain.
And I think he was done in the book in a way that was more likely to what a smart pirate, not a vicious pirate, but a smart
pirate. Or any smart
pirate,
con man
or
in general,
smart
con really.
Man, yeah, exactly, would be like.
Because I think a lot of adaptations actually soften his character quite a bit. When I was reading, because I'm used to the adaptations, but when I was reading this one, I actually found him less likable.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And then in the adaptations, obviously, especially the Treasure Planet one. Which I do like, but we'll talk about that later.
Yeah, no, he's definitely the less likable from.
But they do a good job. They do a really good job if you don't know the story.
Mm-hmm.
Stevenson does a great job of hiding Long John's. Like, they hint early on, obviously, with Billy Bones saying, look out for the one-legged man.
Yeah.
And then Long John Silver is one-legged, and it's like, are you the one-legged man? And then it's like, nah, he's not. No, he's too cool. He's nice. And everything.
And even Jim questions him till the end.
Right. A little bit, but like Jim, but the thing is, like, Long John is so respected by most people, and like he's so amiable and stuff. And so he flies under the radar, you know.
It was the I don't say the twinkle. It was the look he saw in his eye when they were going after the treasure, and Jim realizes I can never fully trust him because he will kill me for money if it comes down to it.
Yeah. It's fun because in the book there's a bit when they're on the island, especially really near the end, when he like invites him to be a pirate, basically.
Oh, yeah.
Which I kind of liked because even the worst people can make a connection with other people.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
Like want that connection and want that familiarity.
Mm-hmm.
And like even the worst people can essentially take on someone like almost like as an apprentice and like want to give them things, you know, like they're people want connections. People want.
I agree.
People want love. People want you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
And so I liked that because it felt real and it kind of humanized him a bit. Mm. Like, he's still a horrible person. And I think even to the end of the book, never was there a time in the book that I thought that, like, he was ever, like, redeemed.
Yeah.
Like, I never really trusted him the whole time, which mm-hmm. I think is the point.
Yeah.
It really just seems like he was out there to protect himself. Mm-hmm. And the one thing I did like about the book that they kind of hinted at, and I don't know if this is meant to be what it was, is it really hints that when he got the map from Dr. Livesey, mm-hmm. that he really knew something was up. Like, he says that, I knew something was up when he gave me the map because he gave it to me way too easily.
Oh, okay.
And he's like, they basically abandoned the stockades and just gave me the map. And he's like, yeah. Why would they do that? Like, because Long John's smart. Like, yes. He knows yeah. there's no reason why they would do that without a fight. Mm-hmm. And so he knows something's up. And so that's when he actually starts planting the seeds of, you know, Jim, we're mates. Mm-hmm. Like we got each other's backs, you know. Like, yeah. I'll protect you. You protect me. I'll protect you, you know.
I think that's probably when he started.
Yeah. And so he was preparing for when they get to exactly. it, when there was no treasure.
That's what he was preparing for. He knew that something was up and he needed to have a foot in both camps.
Right. And he needed to be prepared either way.
Yes. Yeah. Which yeah. I think and Jim so, mentions.
And so I think if Dr. Livesey and them had never given the map and the stockade, mm-hmm. I think he still would have been like the villain the whole time. And
oh yeah. Though there were some, at least one other, who was even more of a villain.
You're talking about Mr. Hands?
Mr. Hands.
Yes. George Mary's pretty bad too, but
yeah, he's just like, not I think
like
Hands
to be fair, there are a lot of times where
the cruelest.
The crew could have done a lot more damage if Long John wasn't there. Oh, yeah. But it's also Long John just being smart mm. and saying essentially, we're just going to act nice and mm-hmm. do our thing and act like sailors, which we are.
Yeah.
And we will get to the island. We will get the treasure. And then when we get closer to home, mm-hmm. we will turn on them. That way we will have a safe voyage.
Yeah.
But the pirates just got greedy and they make a big deal about how like they basically had no self-control, like with them getting drunk and stuff. I liked this because I think people lose sight of the fact that pirates are not good people.
Yeah.
In modern culture, people really like pirates.
Yeah.
And pirates are not good.
No, they're not. Even today. I mean, they're still
Yeah, there are still pirates today.
There are. In the book, the back of the book, I have mentions it. And I've read some news stories recently in the last
year. I think there are definitely people out there who like to pull the, well, they wouldn't do it if they didn't really have a reason to. And I think that's a bunch of nonsense.
Yeah.
But like, there's the romanticized pirates mm-hmm. for sure, but people don't look at the negative aspects of the pub pirates.
I mean, real tangent question. We won't go down it, but just do you like the Disney's pirate movies, Pirates of the Caribbean movies?
I like the first one.
Okay.
The second one's fine, and then the third one's whatever.
Okay.
I kind of don't watch the fourth one.
Okay.
If there's curious. More than I haven't seen them.
Yeah.
I like the first one because I think the first one is the closest to the original attraction before they changed it to be more like the movie.
Yeah. Okay.
I like what they did with it, and I think it was the most fun, and it was a standalone. Mm-hmm. I didn't think they needed to add on to it.
Yeah.
I get why they did because it was making money.
Of course.
yeah. But I really like the first one.
Because when you mentioned the romanticization of pirates,
oh, for sure.
For me, that's like,
yeah.
Yeah.
And then automatically for that one, it's just supernatural and.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and the other thing are we done with Long John or do you have anything else?
The only other thing I was going to say is, if you're used to adaptations, mm-hmm. this will kind of take you off guard. Almost every adaptation will have a final confrontation between Long John and Jim. Mm,
okay.
Where essentially both of them just allow each other to go their separate ways.
Yeah.
But in the book, they don't. Like, they get on the ship and they take off and they know they need a crew because they cannot sail the ship without a crew. And so they have to stop off in Spanish America because mm-hmm. it's the 1700s before the revolution. And so when they're there, that's when Long John just sneaks away.
Yeah.
And he takes a bunch of money. And it was fine. Mm-hmm. I think if you're used to the adaptations, it's a little bit of lackluster because you're wanting that final confrontation. But I never really felt like in the book that he and Jim had much of a relationship, actually.
No, I agree.
And so, like, I was fine with it.
Yeah, so was I. No, and I agree with you about it being hard to drive a galleon by yourself because I've actually driven a galleon by myself.
Stop.
In a video game, Sea of Thieves.
Oh, jeez.
Everyone else logged off and I was by myself on a...
It's exactly the same.
It was hard, though. I had to do the sails, steer it. Anyway.
Yeah, it does take a lot to man a ship.
Even in video games. Yes. The other thing that stuck out and I wanted to bring up was the way Mr. Hands, Israel Hands, dies mm-hmm. in the book is very different than the other two.
Yeah, it's almost... Oh, so I think something I need to say real quick. For anybody who has not seen any adaptation or has read the book, the one thing to remember is all of these pirates were a part of Captain Flint's crew. That's something that yes. they're not just pirates. Like, they were a part of the crew that essentially accumulated all of the treasure.
Mm-hmm.
And so to them, they feel like the treasure is owed to them.
Correct.
And even Ben Gunn, who was marooned, was a part of that crew.
Yeah.
But he was on a different ship later, and he went back to the island and told them the treasure was there. But when they didn't find it, mm-hmm. they marooned him because they basically he basically wasted their time.
He did, yes.
And so that's something, because it does bring a little bit of gravitas and emotional element to it for them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because they've been waiting all these years to get that treasure back and all this stuff.
So, yeah. And so
they're not just random people who wanted treasure. Like, it was the treasure they stole and murdered for.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Because it, like, I didn't actually catch that. I maybe they mentioned it in the beginning, but I didn't catch that until the end when Ben Gunn is doing the voice.
Well, they talk about how, I think they said Long John Silver was the quartermaster on Flint's ship.
He was, and yeah.
I think they said that Billy Bones was the bosun or something. I can't remember. But they all had, like, they were
is
all
it bosun
officers.
Or bosun?
It's probably bosun.
Oh, okay.
I just know when you try to read it phonetically, it's like boxen or something.
It's boatswain.
Boatswain, yes.
I was like, what's a boatswain?
And coxswain.
Yeah. No, and so, yeah, because for me, like, I forgot all about that. I don't remember why. Maybe because I got caught up in the adaptations. And so when at the end they're looking for the treasure and Ben Gunn is in the forest saying the last words that Captain Flint said when he died, and everyone recognizes that's what he said. That's his voice. And then they realize, no, that sounds like Ben Gunn. And then it came back to me, oh, yeah, these are not random pirates. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so it made more sense. Yep. Did the difference in the way that Israel Hands died, did it strike you in any way?
I because I'm used to the adaptations, I was surprised by how long it took until the confrontation between him and Jim.
Because
mm-hmm. in the book, when Jim goes to the ship alone after leaving the stockade secretly,
mm-hmm.
and he like cuts the anchor first. And it was funny because he leaves, but then he like comes back.
Yeah.
Which I thought was weird. It was almost like he accidentally came back.
It was, but, right? Because he got swept away and the ship right. started going away right. and stuff like
so
that.
So it was kind of realistic and that was fine. But I was at the same time, I was just like, just get to it. But when he gets on the ship, he encounters that basically like the pirates had all been drinking, getting drunk, and mm-hmm. like some had killed each other and... Like, they're basically turning on each other and like losing self-control and stuff. Yeah. Like, I kind of liked that motif. It was that theme. It was fun. And Mr. Hands, Israel Hands, was kind of feigning being much more hurt than he was.
Yeah.
And so that Jim wouldn't be as scared of him.
Mm-hmm.
And he kind of played it like, oh, I'm ashamed of all that I've done. I've done so many bad things. Like, would you forgive me? Kind of like, it was kind of the mentality that he had, like, with Jim, essentially.
Yeah.
And then he was like, oh, like, I deserve to die.
But I can't remember if this is written in there, but did he say something like that Jim saw a hint in his eyes or his face or something?
Yeah.
Okay. But I know it wasn't until he hid and saw him pull the knife, but
yeah.
And I noticed
he didn't really trust him.
Yeah.
Like, he kind of was just kind of hearing him out. And because he didn't actually think that he could move very much. He mm-hmm. wasn't really concerned about him as a threat.
Yeah.
Until he went and watched him secretly and he realized, okay, he can move pretty well. Like, I should be concerned.
And I think for me, it was a foreshadowing, or at least of Jim learning. It kind of foreshadows what eventually he sees with Long John later on.
Sure.
The glint in his eye when he...
Yeah, with him, the treasure is near. With Israel Hands, I think he was saying... Like, there was a disconnect between what he was saying and how he was saying it
mm-hmm.
with his facial features.
Yes. Yeah.
And so, like, he sounded sincere, but when you looked at him, there was, like, a hint of hatred and something else.
Mm-hmm.
And so he never trusted him.
Yeah. But the way he died.
It's funny because Jim was so calm.
Yeah.
Jim just like, excuse me, Mr. Hands, I'm going to have to replace this flag. This will not do, you know, stuff like that. I was like, Jim, you are so cool right now.
And then eventually, like, I think in the other adaptations, he gets chased up the mast. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's funny because in the book, because Jim essentially has allowed the ship to drift without an anchor or anything, when he is talking to Mr. Hands and he starts to get concerned that Mr. Hands, because he saw he has a knife now, that's when the ship hits the beach. And so the ship lists to the side.
Yes.
And so the only way he can get away from him without jumping into the water is to climb up the shrouds up to the top of the mast.
Correct, yeah.
Because he didn't think that Mr. Hands could get up it. Mm-hmm. And then he makes it up, obviously, slowly. And then when he's up there, they have the confrontation there.
Mm-hmm.
And then Jim essentially has to shoot him.
Yeah.
Because Mr. Hands throws a knife at him.
Yes. And then, yeah, it hits him in the top of his shoulder.
It, like, pegs him to the mast.
It does, yeah.
But he does say, like, it was just the, it just kind of, like, got pinched him. Like, it just got the end of the skin, but it pinched him to the thing.
And then he shoots him. In the face?
Yeah, doesn't he shoot him with both guns or something?
He takes both guns and then he shoots him, I believe, in the face.
Basically,
and yeah. I found that very, I mean, I had no problem with it, but you wouldn't.
Well, his face was probably the only thing exposed up at the top of the mast.
True, but the way he killed them and then he just falls into the water, it was very, I thought it was really nicely written.
Well, it was very poetic.
It was.
I liked the whole bit about how, because the water was shallow, he could see him in the water, and
the, like, way it glistened.
And it was interesting because it was almost like everything the pirates were doing was all for naught, because in the end it was not going to lead to anything. Because he talks about how, like, the blood would mix with the water, but, like, the fish were all unaffected by it and stuff. And then Jim goes down and he essentially gives a burial to the other pirate that had, I don't know if it was a pirate or just someone else, but
no, it was the pirate. The guy, the pirate with the red cap.
But he throws them overboard and they basically are in the same spot.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It was kind of poetic the way it was written. I liked it.
It was, and I enjoyed it because I had seen the other two adaptations at this point.
Yeah.
The death of, well, he's not called Hamster Hands in Treasure Planet, but the death of that character. I thought it was a lot more gruesome in the book than it was in the other two.
Yes. Well, and I think it also depends on what kind of audience is watching or reading, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because I think the audience that he was, the readers that Stevenson was writing to, I think would not have been as bothered by it.
I think it
was much more of, you know, you did what you had to do.
Mm-hmm.
And Jim didn't really want to do it, but he had to protect himself.
Yeah.
And then you see later on, I think in the 50s adaptation first, it's a little different.
It is, yeah.
Obviously, like, he just has a different, it's only one gun and it's a small one that Long John gave him. But it feels a lot more like Jim's giving him a warning in that one.
Yeah.
And obviously the Treasure Planet one's completely different.
Yeah,
it's different, but it feels like it's still kind of an homage.
Oh yeah, no, I agree.
We'll talk about that.
Yeah,
yeah. One other thing I wanted to say real quick is there were a couple things that did kind of bother me in the book that the adaptations, especially Treasure Planet, I think fix.
Okay.
For me,
mm-hmm.
In the book, Jim really has no reason to go on the voyage. In fact, I would say he has all the reason not to go on the voyage.
Yeah.
Like, the inn was just destroyed by all these pirates, and his mother is now a widow.
Yeah, that's true.
It's funny because in the book, the squire fixed up the inn for them.
And he got
And he hired someone
to help the mom.
Yeah. And so it was like, oh, yeah, you're fine. Don't worry. It seemed more like it was a finder's keeper scenario where it's like, well, Jim found it, so technically it's his, but he brought it to us, so we're all going to take part in it.
Yeah.
But he has to come with us because it's his technically.
Mm-hmm.
And so it just felt – that's why I just kept going back to, this is just for fun, Eric. This is just an adventure. Like, it really doesn't matter. It seemed more like the Squire was the one obviously spearheading the adventure.
Yeah.
Like, he's the one who really wanted to go on the voyage, and he's the one who recruited everybody.
But I think we see those characters even today where it's the kind of the... Mm-hmm. The rich guy who hasn't really done much, or he's lived a very sheltered life, and now he's ready to go on an adventure. He's sure. Like, hey, everyone around me, join right. me. And maybe. He trusts everyone implicitly, except the person
he And he's
trust.
The one who mouths off to everybody.
Yeah.
He keeps telling people secrets.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing in the book that kind of bothered me mm-hmm. is there's a couple times where Jim does things for almost no reason. And that really bothered me.
Like what?
He gets into the jolly boat.
Oh, when he follows the pirates.
Mm-hmm. So he knows already that they're pirates and they're planning to mutiny. Yeah?
Yeah, Jim has a little ADHD.
And there's literally a line where Jim says, I really don't know why I did this.
but I did it.
I decided to get into the boat, and I'm glad I did.
But it has that kind of Tom Sawyer feel where he's just like, oh, let's just do this. Mm-hmm. See where it goes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny because... I get that, but it seemed like there were a couple times, especially later on when he leaves the stockade.
Oh, to go to the ship.
Yeah, when he first leaves the stockade, later, when it makes almost no sense to,
mm-hmm.
he had been in the stockade for a little while because they had been fighting and they were kind of sheltered there. And it seemed like Jim just needed to get away from the death and the craziness.
Yeah.
And he was a little jealous of people who could go outside, and so he just snuck away.
Yeah.
But he felt guilty about it, obviously, because he didn't tell anyone, and he didn't want them to think he was deserting them mm-hmm. and stuff. But he also really just needed to be out.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I kind of understood, but it felt kind of weird. But it was funny because in that section, he would then like give reasons for why it was okay. He'd be like, "Well, then I remembered." The captain did say at one point, if only someone could go and beach the ship. So I'm already out. Why not? You know? So it was like afterthoughts, you know?
Yeah. No, I picked up on those too. And I just kind of brushed over them.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, it's...
It's like the plot needed to move.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, that's really what it came down to.
Yeah. Okay. I think that's it for the book. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, before we finish off this section, we're going to break up this... Treasure Planet, whatever. We'll talk about all the adaptations
in the next episode. Yes.
Hopefully just one more. But before we finish off this one, did you want to talk about your favorite character? Or?
I do. I'm trying to... I'm kind of back and forth between Dr. Livesey. And
I like him because he's stable.
Yeah. But there's a part of me that also does like Long John. Even though he's not my favorite, I found the character interestingly written.
Okay.
But if I have to choose a favorite character, it would be Dr. Livesey.
I always liked Dr. Livesey as like a father figure.
Mm-hmm.
There's a part of me that always really liked Captain Smollett
because
he always had a really good head on his shoulders. But he was also like kind of friendly, especially to Jim.
Yeah.
And he was very smart about things. There's always something about him I always kind of liked because he was always very aware. He was like, I don't trust this crew, but I don't trust... It's not that I trust them enough to not go on the voyage,
yeah.
He says. It's just enough that I'm really concerned. And I need you to know that.
I forgot about that part.
Basically. But I think Jim's my favorite, for sure.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, despite the things about him in the book, I wasn't
Your
a fan
critiques,
of.
Critiques, yeah.
Despite my critiques, I did like Jim in the book. I remember as a kid, when I was in elementary school, we had a day where we had to come dressed up as our favorite fictional characters from books.
Yeah.
And I chose to come dressed up as Jim Hawkins.
That's cool.
Yeah. To be fair, it was mainly because of the 50s adaptation.
Oh, okay.
But I did come dressed up as Jim Hawkins one. And I have a picture with a girl who was dressed up as Amelia Bedelia.
Oh, that's funny.
Cool. All right. Do you want to rate this one, or do you want to rate it in the next one?
I'll get rated in the next one.
Great. All right. Well, thank you for listening to this episode. Please listen to the next one when we talk about the adaptations. We'll talk about the 1950s live-action adaptation and then the 2002 Treasure Planet.
Yep.
And you will talk a lot about that one.
Yes.
Because definitely. I love that one, and I'm sure Rummy hates it.
We'll see. I'm leaving everyone suspense.
Yeah, well, they know.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us.
All right, tune in next time and leave us a comment.
Definitely.
All right, bye.
Bye.
Next time on Willing to Adapt.
And today we're going to talk about the 1950 Treasure Island Disney live action adaptation. Yep. Talked about how the book Treasure Island really helped to solidify in the public awareness the idea of what a pirate was.
Yes.
With a lot of the things in the book.
Mm-hmm.
This film is responsible as popularizing the portrayal of what a pirate is, specifically in how they talk.
Oh, okay.
And then basically it's like, oh, well, look, we found the treasure map. And it's like, okay, you're coming with us, Jim. They do kind of play into the Disney film a lot more of this, that Long John's kind of a good guy.
They do. I feel like I agree with you on that.
Did you like the film adaptation?
I did. I did enjoy it. It was very Disney.
Thank you for listening to our podcast, Willing to Adapt. Please like and subscribe. Maybe leave a review or just share us with friends and family.
We would also love if you would follow us on social media.
If you have ideas for future episodes for us, please email us at ericandromi@willingtoadapt.com.
That's Romy with an I.
And remember, when the only thing constant in life is change, be willing to adapt.